Hello, listener. Before we start this podcast, I wanted to have a quick chat with you about a challenge that you can get involved in. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm going a bit crazy due to the fact that I can't race at the moment. And with that in mind, over the month of June, we're going to be looking back and reminiscing about our greatest ever races. And these are the events that got us hooked on the sport, the races where everything went to plan, we had an incredible run, or just inspirational races that we watched and changed our attitude and approach to the sport. Now, we want to hear your memorable moments. So please take the challenge. Post a picture tagging in us, that's Let's Get Running, and our friends Cliff Bar, that's Cliff with one F, and tell us your stories. And we're going to read some of those out on the show, and some lucky people will win a caddy, that's 18, Cliff Block Energy Chews. So get involved and just join in the reminiscing. Hello, welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. It's me, Sean, a host, no Robbie and Tom from Fast Running this week, but we do have a great interview with you for you today with two-time Olympian and winner of both Paris and the Berlin, I think twice Paris winner and Berlin Marathon winner, Steve Brace. But that's coming up in a bit. If you listened last week to the interview with Tom Gale, we are currently doing a bit of a series where we're looking at three races that have shaped runners' careers. So Steve's going to talk to us about that, looking at the race that kind of got him hooked in athletics, the race of his life, the greatest performance he ever produced, and the greatest race he's ever seen. So he can talk us through those things. Obviously, Steve is kind of his job now is topical too. He is a race director at Run for Wales. Obviously they put on a number of events, including the Cardiff Half Marathon. And Steve's going to talk a bit about kind of, I guess, what's going to happen in the next few months. It was last week I spoke to Steve. And he's going to talk to us about, yeah, exactly what's happening in the world of running at the moment, which is not a lot. So, this is a good one. Check it out. There has been a race over in Norway. I saw the Ingebrigtsen brothers smashed up a 5K, running Norwegian records. It'd be nice for us to get a bit of a chance of that. I think I'm personally desperate to get out there and have a race. My fitness is good. My baby is coming in September, so I'd like to make use of that before that sleep goes completely the other way around. But anyway, this is going to be a good show. If you've just been listening to the beginning of the show, there's been a little advert about a competition. So have a listen again to that. There's a chance for you to win some Cliff Bars. All details at the beginning of the podcast and actually the beginning of all of our podcasts for the next few weeks. If you want to join in, you've got to make a post, a social post, preferably Instagram's good, and talk to us about one of those three races that Steve's going to talk about. So it could be your greatest ever race, which is a good one. The race that got you hooked, or the greatest race you've seen. Probably best to pick from one of the three. Make a post, tag us in, and you're in with a chance of winning that. So get involved. Always rate and review if you can. Share the podcast as much as you can and help us spread the word. So here we go. Here's the show, and here's Steve. On today's show, we are talking to Olympian and race director of a series of races in Wales, Steve Brace. How are you doing, Steve?
Good afternoon, Sean.
I wasn't sure which accolades to mention in the intro there. I could have said Berlin Marathon winner as well, couldn't I?
Yeah, I've had a few varied careers, ranging from teaching, carpentry, right through now to, as you said, athlete and event directing. So, not standing still.
It's been a good innings up to date.
Very enjoyable and... Yeah, I'm very privileged in being able to always do what I've really wanted to do, and it's always worked out. So, it's been a great life so far.
But at the moment, we're going through a bit of a strange period, I guess, when we're sort of in your guise as a race director. Nothing's on. We're waiting, and we don't know what's happening, really. Are you managing to keep busy during this period?
Yeah, totally unprecedented times. You know, event organizations all about preparing for the future and being ready, synchronizing and meshing with so many other worlds, from athletics right through to local councils, etc. And it's all just been shelved. really weird. We've been lucky enough to set up here in Wales a little event organising company run for Wales. And yeah, we've successfully delivered for many years now, since 2012, a whole series of events in Cardiff along the South Wales coast, 10Ks. And the virus has really put, well, as we know, a halt to everything. And it's really unknown circumstances, monitoring how it's going in the rest of the world. But it's the prognosis is not great at the moment. It's, you know, nothing is on the horizon for us getting back to any sort of normality, if I'm honest.
Yeah, good. And so you're in touch with guys at organising races across Europe, and they're in a similar position. There's nothing really kicking off anywhere at the moment.
That's right. What is good at this time, everyone is very keen to share experiences from the IAAF, or World Athletics as it's now called. We've had webinars. There's a lot of people trying to sort the problems out. And obviously we're monitoring countries that are ahead of us in terms. But until we've got that vaccination, until there's runner confidence, you know, that's without, you know, the local councils or the restrictions we can have in place. It's, we're almost going to have to go back to the drawing board. We're going to have to deconstruct our events and build them back up with the environment, with the rules, with the regulations we'll have. And I think it's going to be a very different world in the short term while we get back to hopefully levels of mass events as we've seen in the future, in the past, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, and I mean, lots of stuff's kind of happening in the UK in terms of there's virtual events popping up, and I think a lot of the top athletes have kind of jumped on that, and they're enjoying that. Have you heard of anything else? Any other kind of innovative ideas for getting maybe elite level competition back to the to the streets?
Well, at the moment, of course, is the problem that has been encountered. A lot of elite athletes are now locked down in the country where they're based, where they possibly face with two weeks. You know, before they can actually compete in countries. So the traveling elite athlete is a little bit on hold at the moment. Most of the stuff, as you mentioned, is at a domestic local level. There are some international type events. I know here in Wales there are a weekly virtual mile races, etc. And it's put different, you know, it's put on a different level. It's a stopgap, but it's not really the same. You know, the whole idea of running, racing is being shoulder to shoulder, outwitting your opponents. And I wonder how many people, some people are training harder. Some people haven't got the enthusiasm, I'm hearing as well. It doesn't, you know, until you've got that those target races, something to really plan for, you can't really give that 100% focus.
No. And it was interesting this week. I saw there's obviously over in Norway, they've broken the Norwegian 5K road record. They're certainly getting back to it over there. I didn't see how many people were in the race, but yeah, it looks like they're making tentative steps back to it.
Yes, I heard that. It was a little bit of a family affair, wasn't it? You know, a community, yes. Something that they put on for the community. And yes, it's hit the sort of the news feeds. And yes, it's a start, but you know, we're a long way from running as we know it. And virtual running, you know, it's great. It serves a purpose. But there is something about going to a race, being there, part of whether you're at the elite end, you're there to enjoy it as a club runner, or you're there for your first time. And, you know, one positive out of this is there are definitely more people out there trying to be fit, you know, and it's going to be an interesting restart when we get back, to see how many people start turning up for park runs, how it will change society in their view of, you know, enjoyment and physical fitness, and maybe taking it to the next level. You know, we're hoping it's all going to be very much of a positive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the more people that are running, potentially they're not going to produce Olympians, these people who have just taken up, but you never know, their children. So it might be the one. So maybe in 30 years, this lockdown will help us produce the next Olympic marathon champion from the UK. It's a long shot, but you never know. But I guess with the sort of mass participation is very much kind of on the back burner, but with kind of these smaller community events, I guess there is a chances for maybe, you know, things like national road relays and stuff. These aren't necessarily off the
off the table, but I guess it's a difficult question to ask you that sort of whether you think we'll see some kind of competition before the before Christmas comes around.
I think your local clubs events that can get organised quite quickly, I think we'll see those, and that'll go up the scale then as people are more confident, and some of the other bigger events before hopefully getting back to full-scale athletics as we knew it.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can see that in the future soon. We'll keep our eyes peeled on that. But we guess we shouldn't spend too much time thinking about things we can't give a definitive answer on. But we can talk about is what's happened already in your career. So I guess we want to, this is kind of a part of a feature we're doing over the next few months, looking at athletes' careers sort of through the means of discussing three key races in their development. So we're going to talk about three races that have affected your life and your career as a runner. And the first question, the first sort of race I want to talk about is almost the race that got you hooked on the sport. So the inspiration with which you then took the sport up and went ahead with it and obviously reached the heights that you did. Have you got like one single race that where it sort of clicked for you as a junior or when you started the sport?
Well, I started, although I did a bit of athletics in school, mainly because I wore glasses, and football and rugby, I just had a difficulty with vision. But then later on, when contact lenses, I started playing rugby again. And on those boggy pitches, we used to go for a run, and I found I was quite good at this running lark. And this was in the, the 80s. And I used to be sort of better at the running than the rugby. And that slowly, over a number of years, I went from being a rugby player to enjoying races. And I was just at the start of the big 80s marathon boom. And I did the 1981 People's Marathon up in Birmingham. And that was, 3.5 hours, rubbed all my legs, rotten on shoes. It was very much the start of a career, and I married rugby and running together for 4 or 5 years, but really they weren't really compatible of being smashed around on a Saturday and trying to run races the following day. And things developed over that period, and yes, but by the sort of mid to late 80s, my running career was really starting to take off. So that People's Marathon, John Walker, Centurion Runners, was really the catalyst which got me into and changed my lifestyle, and wouldn't be here today if I hadn't found running at that time, really.
And what was it? So it was painful 3.5 hours you got around. What was it particularly that got you, that made you think, this? I'm going to give this another crack?
Oh, I thought I could do better. That was a big thing. And I think I've done about 50 odd marathons in my career. And I think I went on to do about another 6 or 7 that year then. The running boom, the Western Mail Marathon, which is a big Cardiff half at that time, Cardiff Marathon at that time. And I was just jumping in because I didn't know any better. Then we had a rugby club athletics league locally down in South Wales, and that went well. And I joined a club, Bridgend Athletic Club then, and really I learnt off others quite quickly of not doing things wrong myself.
And not doing 7 marathons in a year.
That's right. So I reduced all that, and wouldn't change it. You do a lot of learning, and I was a carpenter, working in schools, etc. And eventually, I took myself back to college, and that was quite a critical point. And met up outside Newport Gwent College, and got used to really training Mike Rowlands, who was of course Steve Jones at the time, and used to do a lot of the sessions, and really put my head down then in those late 80s, and turned myself into a half reasonable athlete then by the mid to late 80s.
And so how quickly did it take from you sort of doing this 3:30 to realizing you had a real talent, and you were competitively running, sort of getting down sort of 2:30s and below? How quickly did you make that step?
It was fairly quickly. I learned quickly because you don't want to do things wrong. I had reasonable pace judgment, and I think Wolverhampton, I ran about 2:25 in Wolverhampton, and that was a big a big stepping stone. I remember, you know, we all have these ideas of breaking the 3-hour barrier, and I ran so close to that a few times and then took big chunks off, which was the irony. And, yeah, by the late 80s then, I'd really sort of progressed, in 2:14. So, and then, you know, by the early 90s then, so within 10 years, I was down to 2:10 then. In winning Berlin.
And what was the experience then of going in sort of to Newport and going and training with Steve at the time? Was he as famous an athlete as he is now? Was he then kind of, you know, going for world records and going for wins in big city marathons?
Well, he wasn't there that much, although he popped in. It was very much when he was running in the States. But there was a whole group of good Newport runners. Newport were a very strong team, used to be European clubs, and there was a whole wealth of good runners. And it was about 3-4 miles away, the clubhouse, so we used to run down there. Or we used to go to Cwmbran Stadium, which was one of the first tartan tracks at the time. So all the sessions were done. It always took me 4 miles to get either to their clubhouse or the track. So I used to run there, do the sessions and run back. So I was slowly, without knowing, putting some big mileage in place. And then as a student, morning runs. And it worked out, you know, all well. And yes, Steve was at the height of his career then, you know, winning the New Yorks and the Chicagos during that period. And meanwhile, I was very active within the Bridgend Athletic Club as well, and we had a number of good runners through that late 80s, early 90s. I think we had 7 GB marathon runners in our club alone. Wow. Time. So it was a great period, a lot of hard work, a lot of miles, but that's where all the bread and butter, and that was where the apprenticeship was really sort of set out.
Yeah, and so at the time you were working while training, how did you make that fit? Was it a difficult task at times?
Well, I became a teacher, I was still doing, you know, the 100 plus miles as a teacher. But the difference was the rest and recovery. And I suppose the next tipping point, I got selected for the Commonwealth Games in Auckland in 1990. And because it was in Auckland, it was a winter games. And I wasn't allowed to have time off to go and run the marathon down there for Wales. So I hadn't been teaching that long, a year and a bit, and I packed that in, and I came back, and I was lucky enough to win the Paris Marathon within a few months. So that really set out then. And the only difference, I became a full-time athlete, and the only difference between a full-time athlete, the mileage wasn't different. It was the rest, recovery, and time to plan, and the quality of the training. So yeah. And my career just really went then in the early 90s, say after Auckland, which ran okay, 7th, 8th place or whatever. But I came back and I won the Paris Marathon, which came out of the blue.
Yeah. And what was it? So obviously, you mentioned there was in Bridgend, you had 7 or 8 guys who'd represent Britain. And there was an incredible standard of runners kicking around in the UK in the 80s. Like, what was it? A few, you mentioned the thing that got you hooked was the wanting to, you knew you could do better and you wanted to improve yourself, but did it really help you that having this amount of people who could compete internationally, did that really help you kind of make the step yourself? Was it an inspiration to you to be running against these guys, or was it just you knew you could, it was almost like testing yourself out to see which, you know, how far you could take yourself?
Yeah, having quality runners around you was a big factor. And, you know, we used to train together, which was quite unique as well, quite a bit. Greg Newhams, Dale Rickson, Gareth Davis, you know, all sub-220, sub-220 marathon runners. But it wasn't just that. We went to every 3A's championships, whether it's 10K, 10 miles, half marathon, and, you know, week on week running against Tipton, Harriers, Swansea, Cardiff. They were all very strong and all supported the national championships at that time. And it was very much a week in, week out, you know, when I used to be called Race the Race, because I used to love racing. You know, I think I did 74 races one year. I possibly over, you know, people say over raced, but I had a different frame of mind. I was very, I'm, a lot of those races were community type events, and you know, a lot of those races were no harder than when I'd beat myself in a training session. I just loved going to races, being part of that whole races. And we had races in every valley, every town here in South Wales in that period. It was a big running boom. And just learned how to race, how to put on, you know, mileage. And I could accept defeat. You know, some races I wouldn't win that I should have, but I knew I would have done 100, 100, 120 miles that week. And you just get on with it because I knew what was important. And quite a critical point, when I started doing a lot of physiological tests, it was obvious from my VO2 max that I had fallen into the right distance. My VO2 max suggested I could never have been a great 10K or half marathon runner. I had by accident found the right distance. And, you know, it was all, I say, for years, just putting on the mileage, averaging 18, 90 miles a week per year for about 5-6 years, right through to the early 90s. You know, which was good mileage, and really set off, you know, some of my better performances then in the early 90s, around 2:10 a couple of times. You know, 26 of my marathons were all sub 2:20, 14 of them were under 2:15, and you know, and I was a good racer. I wasn't a good runner. I raced people, which that got more out of me.
You say you weren't a good half marathon runner, Steve, but didn't you get second in the World Half Marathon Championships at one stage?
No. I was very modest at half marathon. My 10K half marathon times really didn't reflect what I was able to do with a marathon. My a downhill Lisbon course was my PB, 62.04. Other than that, it was the Great North Run. 62.5 was my personal best. You know, 10K, I only had 29 minutes for 10K, never broke 29 minutes. 10 miles was a little bit better. Portsmouth around 47.5 there. 5K is very modest for a 2:10 runner as well, you know, 14 minutes. But it was just my ability to operate close to that VO2 max threshold through years of mileage and believe, you know, continuity of training, as I say, my consistency over that period, year in, year out, until I started having a couple of niggles, because the body, although the mind can be strong, the body can be weak at times, and paying now a little bit on the old knees and the hips, but I wouldn't change that. But I used to
What then do you think was your the greatest race of your life then? What did it all kind of come together and you gained the performance of your life?
I think the one that really put me up there, which the Berlin Marathon. You know, I ran 2:10:59, which wasn't my fastest time, but it was in 1991. I was in great shape. I'd run well in a couple of 10Ks and a half marathon going into Berlin at the end of September, and it just all happened. In the race, outside of the race, everything was a disaster. From the time I got there, the accommodation, I had the family, young children. We stayed in Alexanderplatz in Berlin, little room, trying to get I remember carrying the pushchair to the start over people's head. But when I got in the race, it just clicked. The pace was very modest early on, which was a big thing for me, because if it went off, I went into some races, I ran too fast through the half marathon, which was to my detriment. But if I was around about the 65 minutes, which it was in Berlin that year, and I came back in 65. So even pace running, I got to say, though, it was the year after Steve Monaghetti and the wall came down, so the quality of the field wasn't quite as good. But out sprinted Mark Platz, who was a world marathon champion at the time, the South African who ran for America. Out sprinted him in the last couple of 100 meters, and that was really defining, because not only did it give me a fantastic time, which led for me to be selected for the Barcelona Olympics, in terms of Adidas, I was Adidas contracted athlete then for 10 years. I remember it appeared on Grandstand at the time, and all of a sudden, from 1990 to 1991, it was a really bit of a golden 18 months, also winning Paris in that time. And I got third in New York in that time as well, behind Douglas Wakahuri. It all came together nicely. I won't say through luck, because you make your own luck with all the mileage you do. But
Feel about then that crossing the line? Then did you know kind of the enormity of it when you were chasing down that last couple of 100 meters?
Well, Mark had done a lot of the work, and I was hanging in there. So I was a great racer. I was never a good runner. I couldn't, you know, national road relay. I wasn't somebody who could push myself hard, but I could always stay in a bubble. I could always stay in a lead pack, forget about my watch, and I'd just hang in there. And I did have a very fast finish, although, and that's what I played into my hands a few times, and that's what happened there. Because I wasn't wearing my glasses, I did mistake a banner across the road on a railway bridge for the finish line going down the road. But I hang on, because I knew how far I could sprint, and I won the Paris Marathon in a sprint as well. So I could stay in that bubble and just wait, hang on and wait and wait, and believe and have a great belief that I could outpace people faster than me at the end of races. And it was it's something that I worked on a lot in my career, and that's how a lot of my best times were, by being a good racer.
Give yourself a chance. We were talking to Tom Gale last week about kind of the I think it was the Olympics, was Kipketer, he lost the 800, and a German guy won the race, and he was saying sometimes you just got to stay in there and just give yourself a chance, and you just never know what's going to happen. And I guess you were able to do that, even over a distance like the marathon. You were able just to get your head down and just stay in with the chance.
Exactly. And it's all mind games. It's staying out there. You know, you can feel awful, but staying outside of their eye line, you know, breathing heavy, etc. And then, you know, when the sprint comes, just coming out, you know, out of their field of sight, go past them fast. And 9 out of 10 runners will give in if you go past somebody fast. And always making sure that you had enough strength to go all the way to the finish line from whenever you make that move. I was religious. Every time I used to go to events, I used to my warm-up used to be from the finish line backwards, working out the lamppost or wherever I thought I could sort of make a sprint, knowing the wind direction, every twist, every corner of those last couple of hundred meters. Should I need to use that sprint? Invariably, I didn't. But it was just those games, that preparation, that knowledge of knowing, you know, when you were going to do it, and having that confidence to say to go past somebody fast and make sure you can hold that to the line. And it worked. That worked on all but my fastest race, where in Houston, the Ethiopian Turbo Tumo. He was a class apart, but he came back at me. Although I took the lead, he got back at me at the last sort of 40 metres. He was one of the few guys I ever encompassed who just didn't give in when I went past him.
And that was 2:10:35, was it, you ran there?
Yeah, 2:10:35 in Houston, and 2:10:50-odd when I won 57 when I won Berlin in 91. Houston, ironically, it got me my Atlanta Olympic place. I was in 94. I'd had a little period off before Houston because of my knees were playing up a little bit. I'd had them washed out because, as my surgeon often said, when it came to the knees department, I was more of a Skoda than a Rolls Royce when it came to those joints. I saved my best two fastest marathons for when I needed to. And I wasn't far out. In 88, I was behind Charlie Spedden. I think I was fourth Brit in London in about 2:12 in 88. And that was a catalyst where Charlie went to LA, I think it was then. And I thought, well, 4 years' time, I can really do this if I get my head down.
Yeah. And so going to the Olympics must have been an incredible experience. Did you enjoy those two?
Barcelona, yes. I was fairly well travelled in Europe doing races by the 92 Olympics. I'd finished the Barcelona in second place marathon previous to that. I knew the course. Of course, it was the dreaded Montjuïc Hill was Barcelona. Worried about the heat. It was a 4 o'clock start for television, and it was the last time that the marathon actually finished inside the arena for the closing ceremony. And I had a good run, although that the position wasn't great, just 3-4 minutes off the winner, I think about 26th place. And yeah, it was a point to point. Fantastic city, the Olympics. I spent a lot of time there prior to it. And yeah, very fond memories of Barcelona. It was a great Olympics. Atlanta, yeah. Not so much. It was a hilly city. Actually, I'd been a number of times to Florida. So actually myself and Paul Evans, who was running the 10,000 meters in Atlanta, we legged it down to Florida from Tallahassee, the training camp. And we had a couple of weeks down there training with a few guys we knew down there. And but it was, yeah, Atlanta was was hard. I really struggled in Atlanta. It just didn't suit me. And really, the story of my career, I relatively didn't do well in championships. You know, I was a full-time athlete in 1990, had to make two paydays a year, couldn't really make it over the 10K and the half marathon. Obviously, we had all BAAB trust funds during that time as well, so you had to sort of get your money out. So, I you know, two paydays a year, spring and autumn, and I had to make sure I was consistent to make sure I got those.
Yeah. And with Atlanta, because I was thinking when you were talking earlier about the height of kind of community races and strong endurance running during the early sort of the late 80s and things. But then 96, I guess, it seems to be, certainly from an athletics point of view, kind of like a nadir for British athletics, where they needed to then pick themselves up. Did you notice anything changes in terms of like sort of local? Was there as much competition around in the mid to late 90s? Did things tail off in terms of the number of races you could do, or just was it just a top level we weren't doing quite as well as we had been previously?
I think the political landscape was obviously all very difficult then with BAF going bankrupt and new sort of organisations have to be being set up. It did peter out for whatever reason, and I don't really know. We kept reasonably strong as a club, but performances went down, rankings went down a little bit, and I don't know whether it was the club scene, whether, you know, that's very much the start of the whole internet. You know, clubs suffered a little bit with the terms of numbers. And coaches, I think there's not one item. I think it was just a society change in many respects. Races were there, accuracy, you know, a lot of course races were now being accurate as well. A lot of sort of standardization did come in. There was a lot of change during that time.
Yeah. And so how long after the Atlanta did you continue to compete? Was you said your knees were slightly challenging, let's say, in the mid-90s. Did you give it much of a go after that?
Well, it was going to be my swan song. I think that was my 50th marathon, Atlanta. I was going to pack it in 96. But I came back and I was still running half reasonably well. And I knocked out a couple of 63, 64 half marathons. And I jumped into the new to London because it was a qualifying event for the Commonwealth Games. I ended up finishing my career actually out in Kuala Lumpur, running for Wales in 98. So that was my last sort of official marathon. So I ended up doing 52 marathons in my career. However, I did do 53, but I forget about that. I did do the New York Marathon in about 2003 in about 4 or 5 hours, which the pain of that, having run 2:12 in New York, 2:12, 2:13 in New York, and then to run it at twice the speed, it was quite in memory. But so I finished with a Welsh vest on in 1998 as opposed to a GB vest on in 1996.
Fantastic. I remember Steve Jones saying something about how when he was a coach, he'd run around with a couple of the guys he coached and said that it's much harder doing it running 4 hours than it is doing it two, because you're out there for so much longer. Makes the whole thing last, the pain lasts so much longer.
It is, and ironically, during the lockdown now, I haven't run for years, and I've just started doing a little jog now and again, and oh, it's painful. I do a lot of cycling now. I get on a bike. It's far more sympathetic on the joints and that, but because we get a bit of a lockdown club challenge, I've been trying to participate, and oh, it's my weight is against me, let alone my joints. It's all payback at the moment.
Fantastic. So we're going to go on to the last race. Which is basically the race the greatest race you've ever seen. So it could be from your sort of guise as a race director. It could be a race that inspired you when you're competing, or perhaps as a junior runner. What is the greatest race you've ever stood and watched as a spectator, either on the TV or in person?
There was a lot of great races. I remember the Lopez de Castella race way back, and I remember watching that on television, and I think that was Rotterdam. But the race, ironically, was the World Half Marathon that we hosted in Cardiff back. Yeah. And to watch Geoffrey Kamwara take that field apart in awful conditions, and what he did to a world-class team, having fallen on the start line, he zigzagged all the way back through the masses to get back to the lead pack within a mile. What he must have done for that first mile, I don't know. And then to go on and run 59 minutes, Cardiff, okay, it's fairly flat, but you know, it isn't the flattest of courses, and what could have been that today. You know, more 20 countries ran, you know, 15 kilometer bests, and he just took them apart. And if you've ever seen the coverage, the rain was coming sideways, the wind was coming sideways.
Steve, I was in the race. Steve, I ran. I couldn't believe it when someone told me that he'd run 59 minutes. I was hit at one point with the wind, and I virtually stopped. It was on one section. I couldn't believe it when someone told me he'd broken 60 minutes. Incredible running.
Yeah, and we had all sorts of contingencies for cancelling the race, of getting all the VIP stands, because it was at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon, and the storm was due to come in at 2 o'clock. We had all our volunteers sitting on the drinks tables to stop them blowing away. Flags were snapping. and to say what he did. But he did, and Mo ran well, and the time he put on the field behind him, having had that bad start, and to get back into, you know, a sense of race, and just to run away with that field was, you know,
incredible
for me. And he's gone on to prove himself, obviously, since that, you know, with some other great performances. But yeah, I was obviously very close to that, the weather, and knew, you know, the difficulties, and yeah, it was one of those things that nearly 5 years ago now, but that was sort of tenacity at its best, overcoming the odds and the weather.
Yeah, fantastic. That's a great choice. Hopefully we'll see some top athletics back on Cardiff in the next few years. We'll get another race like that down there. It'll be pretty nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, we've had the Commonwealth Championships there the other day, which, you know, we're well under the hour now for the elite field down there, and it goes from strength to strength. You know, the city welcomes the event. It's really really been taken into heart by the Welsh public and beyond, and it's quite unique. You know, the course starting at the castle, it has all the bay, then goes into the old part of the city, and then that fantastic finish then down at the university. It's really from, we took it over in 2012, and you know, we've been able to expand that with the Run for Wales team, and we've got a lot of great guys, and we put in that sort of knowledge that we learned there into some of the other events around South Wales, and yeah, just be keen to get back at it, and giving opportunities for, you know, the best runners, the club runners, and the first timers, because running is embedded in the DNA of most people, and within my DNA, and it's long we hope should it continue.
Yeah. There's no other sport where you can turn up and you can run the same course at the same time, and essentially you're competing against some of the greatest athletes in the world, like Olympic champions and, you know, Commonwealth champions, all these sorts of things. There's no other sport you can do. Football, you're never going to play against Lionel Messi. You know, cricket, you're never going to get a chance to bowl to, I don't know, I was going to say Andrew Strauss, who's probably a bit retired since then, but there's no other sport where you have that opportunity to be, you know, on a par or to compete against these guys. It's something else.
That's right. And, you know, and even more so now, you know, back in the sort of 80s, 90s, it wasn't as much of a sport for all. You really had to be in a club to get the knowledge, the understanding. Now, you know, it's great to see everybody from every facet of life, you know, all sizes, just getting out there, all the inhibitions gone. And, you know, the park run, you know, I'm very much involved there with the local Pathcall park run. And it's fantastic to see people year on year improving and becoming, you know, far more focused. And their whole lifestyle, it's not just through running, but it does change lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I shouldn't keep you too much longer, Steve. I've actually got three quick fire questions, which I'm not sure I mentioned to you. But they are, if you could be anywhere running now, where would it be?
Oh, that's a very good question. I did like Florida. I used to go over there quite a bit, although it was very sticky. St. Pete's Beach, down St. Petersburg's Beach, some lovely golf courses down there, and spent a lot of springs down there doing a bit of warm weather training. So, yeah, that would be nice.
Perfect. And second question is, can you recommend us something? So it can be, well, I guess, entering a Run for Wales race could be one of them when they come back on, but recommend either a book, a film, or an experience our listeners should check out.
Oh.
Tough one to spring in.
Yeah. Sorry, did you say a race as well, or?
Yeah, it could be a race, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Come back to that one. Hang on a second.
And we'll go with the final question would be, is what, in your opinion, is the greatest endurance single performance? I guess Geoffrey Kamworo was one of them of all time.
Single performance. Possibly more London, the double, you know, when he the pressure. It wasn't just performance, it was the environment. And I think some of Moore's races, how he's been able to pick himself up and manage everything, the circumstances, the environment, and to come back and deliver in the midst of expectation. You know, it takes tough cookie mentally, physically, and people don't see all the work that goes in just for those few moments.
Absolutely.
And I just thought of the book. It was a favourite of mine. I still got it on my shelf. The Lore of Running, Tim Noakes. It was a bit of a Bible for me when I was learning the trade and understanding a little bit of the psychology, the physiology, the nutrition. Going to that next level from just being a plain runner to just getting a bit of an education on it, and you know, so read that and thumb through that, and some great stories of all the runners of the past that had gone before then, in the late 90s. That was I'd put that up there as a key piece of literature for me.
Fantastic. Well, thanks a lot, Steve, for all your time, and fingers crossed things start to change, and perhaps making sort of maybe get a vaccine sorted, we can get this our love for running and competing back on the road.
Yeah, that's fine.
Thanks, Steve.